Next case of the day, which is Schreiber Brothers Hog Company, LLC versus Schreiber. Mr. Domina, good morning to you, and let's give folks a minute to get in and out of today's courtroom. And Mr. Brown, good morning to you also. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
No.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Domina, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of Jerry Schreiber in a case against his brother involving their hog company. These two brothers and a third brother formed a partnership to create a hog business to farrow and finish swine and sell them for market. And they built a couple of buildings along the way. The two buildings are at the center of this controversy. The buildings were constructed when they were a partnership. One of the partners left the partnership. The two remaining partners formed the limited liability company that is the appellee in this case. That limited liability company, when it was formed, acquired the assets of the partnership. They included these two buildings. The limited liability company didn't build the buildings, it didn't borrow the money to build the buildings, and it wasn't induced by anything other than the desire to switch forms of business to come into existence. This lawsuit started as an action to dissolve that limited partnership, and the court resolved that issue with a stipulation of the parties and an appointment of a receiver.
That limited liability company?
The name of the company?
No, I mean, you said to dissolve the limited partnership.
I meant the limited liability company. Thank you for correcting me. Yeah, it certainly was the LLC that was being dissolved. And so all of the work in the case subsequent to the appointment of a receiver is to dissolve the limited liability company. That brings us to the dispute between the parties on the standard of review for this court. This court has recently said that unjust enrichment claims, because they are quasi-contractual, are actions at law. I have taken the position in our briefs that this is an action in equity. Because this court has said that actions to dissolve limited liability companies are actions in equity. And in this case, there was a temporary injunction issued early in the case, which was never dissolved, continued until the conclusion of the case. So the trial court granted equity by appointing a receiver, by granting injunctive relief, and by proceeding to the rest of the case. This court has said that when a case is tried under a particular theory, that theory controls what the standard of review is on appeal. And here the parties tried this case as an action in equity. Now the difference between
the temporary injunction somehow tar the entire case?
Well, Your Honor, I think the answer to that is yes, because of our rule that once equity takes control of a matter, it retains control of the matter until it has resolved all of the issues. There isn't any question that under your decisions, injunctive relief is equitable. There's no question that dissolution of an LLC is equitable. And the rest of this is incidental to those two things. So I think the answer is in the affirmative.
Why would we not review anything having to do with the court's equitable power as an equitable matter and review its unjust enrichment determination as a legal matter, given the Waste Connections case you refer to?
Waste Connections surely does allow the court to make a division along the lines that you suggest, Your Honor. However, in this case, we have a statute in the Limited Liability Company Act which requires that the debts and obligations of the LLC be satisfied in the liquidation process. The unjust enrichment claim in this case is strictly about who gets what out of the limited liability company and who has to pay the debts. So it seems to me that while this was called an action for unjust enrichment, it's genuinely incidental to the relief required to dissolve a limited liability company under Section 21-148 of the Limited Liability Company Act. And so for that reason, I do not think that the Scotts Bluff versus Waste Management case allows the distinction that might otherwise be drawn between the two in a different case. And of course, it's important here principally because the standard of review allows you to either make a new decision or to be handcuffed by the decision of the trial court, if I may call it that on your behalf, by decisions concerning credibility made when the court evaluated the witnesses below.
Assume for just a second that we disagree with your division on what's law and what's equitable, and that we review the unjust enrichment portion of the district court's decision as if it was a matter of law using that standard of review. What issues in an unjust enrichment determination are issues of fact, and what issues are issues of law?
I'll do my best. Your Honor, I would say that obviously issues of credibility are questions of fact. Issues about whether a debt is an obligation of the limited liability company, like the laundry list of debts in my claims, my last assignment of error, those are issues of fact. The question about whether there is an ownership interest retained by the limited liability company in these two buildings is, I think, an issue of fact, because it's driven by the intentions of the parties and their conduct during the course of performing their limited liability company contract, their operating agreement. So I think all of those things would be issues of fact. I might prefer to give you the other answer. However, in this case, it makes no difference for this reason. There is no dispute about the fact that the buildings themselves were sold by the receiver. Not the land, the buildings were sold and the sale was approved. We have a price. That's number one. Number two, the brother I do not represent, who is aligned with the appellant hog company here, testified that he would raise the buildings, no value, rather than risk letting his brother have anything out of them. But his evidence, which he defends on appeal, is that the buildings have a value of $450,000. Well, on the question of credibility, I feel like I'm in a pretty good spot there, so I'm not troubled by the difference between the standards of review. On the question of whether the company should pay its debts, I think that's an easy matter, as judging it as a question of fact. Only one person testified about those debts. There is one exhibit for each debt we claim, and the person who testified about them was my client, uncontradicted. So what we're asking you to do is to reverse the trial court, remand this case with instructions to complete the dissolution of the limited liability company, order that the debts we claim under our fifth claim be paid out of the proceeds of sale, set aside the judgment, which divides the $450,000 that should not have been awarded, and complete the case on that basis. Now, I want to say, Your Honor, go ahead.
Yeah, one of your arguments with respect to unjust enrichment, or maybe the primary argument, is that this is a matter that's governed by contract, and that therefore unjust enrichment has no place. What is the contract? And if there's alternative arguments, what are the contracts?
No, I don't think there are alternative arguments. There are actually two documents that make up the contract, and they are the Articles of Organization and the Operating Agreement of the Limited Liability Company. The Articles of Organization contain a dissolution section, and the Operating Agreement contains a dissolution section. In addition to that, the Limited Liability Company Act itself says that where there is no operating agreement, the state statute functions as the operating agreement. So I don't think there is any powerful way, I won't say credible way, but no powerful way to argue that this is not a case governed by the contracts of the parties.
Is there any tension between those documents, let's call them contracts, right, and any of the statutes?
In the limited liability company?
In the limited liability dissolution world.
No, I don't recall perceiving any tension between the provisions in those contracts and the statute. There are provisions of the statute that might be supplemental, but I don't think they're important.
Which are
here.
To the effect of filling in the blanks if the documents don't cover what's unfolding?
That's correct, and that's, of course, what the statute itself says that the Act is supposed to do. If you don't adopt one or you don't adopt a complete one.
21-110 little A. Fill in the blanks.
You inherit the statute. That's right. I'll reserve whatever meager seconds I have for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Brown, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is John Brown, and I represent the appellee in this case, Schreiber Brothers Hog Company. Justice Castle, you pointed out in the previous case that we're here today in front of law students, and that reminded me of several situations in law school when I was looking at a fact pattern on an exam, thinking to myself, well, there's no way that this is ever going to happen in real life. Well, I stand corrected. We have this case, which is, as Mr. Domina pointed out, a bit of an unusual fact pattern, and we also have the Trickett v. Spahn case that's cited heavily in our brief out of Arkansas. I will start by addressing the scope of review issue, because I think that's probably the most heavily contested issue that we have here. This case was bifurcated, as noted by the district court in its order. The second trial, which was appealed, and we're here today to discuss, solely on the issue of unjust enrichment. It really has nothing to do with the dissolution of an LLC. The appellant conflates the dissolution of the LLC action and the appointment of the receiver with the action on the unjust enrichment. In fact, you could have this same exact factual pattern except remove the defendant as a member of the LLC. The claims would be the same. If you had a recipient of property for less than fair value on a piece of land that was owned by, you know, for hypotheticals, the third brother that was removed from the original partnership, the elements would all still be there. So the standard of review in this case is one as a matter of law. We're looking for whether or not the trial court in its decision made a clearly erroneous decision. Justice Papik, you asked, what is the standard for an unjust enrichment action? And I think the Equestrian Homes case answers that and says that their unjust enrichment is an issue of fact. You are looking for testimony as to whether or not there was a benefit conferred, whether that benefit was retained, and whether in fairness and justice that ought to be compensated or returned.
Those are issues of fact, but your brief also refers to the Waste Connections City of Scotts Bluff case. And that case had language, does it not, that unjust enrichment recovery is available only where, in a circumstance where the law of restitution would authorize a recovery. That sounds legal to me. Am I wrong about that?
Yes. No, you're not, Judge. The issues themselves and the elements are issues of fact. But unjust enrichment, I mean, this is an action at law. It's not one of equity, as pointed out in Waste Management and in your opinion in Blowdorn as well, which cites heavily to Waste Management and very, very well sums up the quasi-contract quantum merit application of unjust enrichment in our legal jurisprudence.
So does the court need to make a legal determination first about whether this is a circumstance that the law of restitution would authorize a recovery before getting to the factual questions you mentioned about whether there's a benefit conferred, whether it's retained, and whether in justice and fairness the defendant ought to disgorge?
The court can certainly take a look and see what if this case is one of those limited circumstances. I would offer that it absolutely is. So whether the court makes the determination that that is a legal question reviewed de novo, or whether that's a question that has to be answered by looking at the record, the answer will come out either way. This is a case in which the circumstances clearly should avail itself to the standards of unjust enrichment.
Why is that if they're not going in that direction already?
The appellant would argue that there is a contract or there are contracts that govern this situation, govern the interplay between the parties, and that's simply not the case. The appellant's reply brief even admits there are no provisions within the Articles of Organization or the Operating Agreement that govern the property that was submitted to the LLC from the partnership. There really is no other recourse for the LLC to recover, which is arguably one of its largest single assets, the value of that asset, and would effectively allow one of those members, and as I articulated earlier, it could be anybody, not just a member, but it would allow one of those members to reap the windfall of a large asset that was contributed to by all members of the LLC.
Are we into the statute to which I referred with Mr. Domina then? Is this covered by the contract?
The statute would clearly be incorporated into areas of the operating agreement that don't cover the issues of the statute. However, even the agreements themselves, I think, specifically ignore the application of these hog buildings. When you look at the capital contributions referenced in the operating agreement, they simply reference $500 provided by each member, and we know that that is not the case. There's no dispute about the fact that the equipment...
I beg your pardon, but was that $500 just a token at the creation of these businesses?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. There's nothing specific to that on the record, but I think that is the obvious implication.
Mr. Domina argues that your clients and the company just made a bad bargain. Could you respond to that?
A bargain implies a meeting of the minds. There's no evidence on the record, and Judge Steinke references this in his order as well. There's no evidence in the record that they ever contemplated what would happen to these hog buildings, how they would be accounted for upon a dissolution of the LLC or a dissolution of the partnership. So I can't understand why there would be reference to a bad bargain when
they knew going in what the situation was. There was some discussion about why would you put the hog buildings on property owned by one partner and not carve it out to be owned by the LLC. So, I mean, it was plenty of light being shown on this unusual situation before it was ever started. Does that have any bearing?
No, I agree, and I'm not. I don't want to imply that my client or the company was somehow hoodwinked or defrauded. They went into this eyes wide open as well, and similar to the Trickett v. Spahn case, where you had a family build a home on another, on an in-law's property. I think there are expectations sometimes when you're in business with family that maybe blind you to some of the legal outcomes. Certainly as a lawyer, I would not have advised this transaction be set up the way it was.
Is fraud an element of unjust enrichment?
Absolutely not. I know appellant goes into great lengths in their appeal briefs to try and assert some element of fraud, duress, into unjust enrichment, but the court's decisions have been clear that there is no element of fraud required for a finding of unjust enrichment.
Ultimately, some people, perhaps many people, would look at the facts of this case and say that the judge came up with a valuation that is simply much greater than what most of the evidence would indicate. There's certainly a lot of evidence in the record that these barns were close to decrepit. How do you respond to what might be an excessive valuation argument?
The judge simply found that evidence to be incredible, Your Honor. There's also evidence by a licensed appraiser to the valuation of the buildings. It was in the defendant's best interest to try and devalue those buildings as much as the defendant could to try and lower that valuation. But the judge weighed the competent evidence and found that the valuation was $400,000+ based on that appraiser's evidence and had the ability to weigh both the defendants.
So there were appraisals from 445 to 550, something like that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it's Exhibit 9 offered at trial as the appraiser. And then we also called the appraiser at the trial court level to have him testify. There was evidence via testimony from the appraiser and from Steve Schreiber, the other plaintiff, that contradicted the evidence submitted by the defendant as to the decrepitation of the buildings, and that they believe that the buildings could be utilized again for their purpose within a matter of days, or if not weeks.
Counsel, I have not looked at the evidence in the Bill of Exceptions, but assist me. In an appraisal of that kind,
wouldn't the appraiser take into account that the buildings were located on someone else's land?
Yes. Specifically, we asked the appraiser to take a look at the valuation of the land without the buildings and compare that to the valuation of the land with the buildings. The difference being the increase in value to the parcel of property, to the parcel that those buildings bring. The appraiser also included an income-based appraisal to show the amount of income that could be generated, and the defendant admitted on the stand that the income was over $1 million per year that could be generated from the hog farming operation connected to those buildings. So we really, the valuation is the increase in the value of the land conferred by those buildings.
Is there a market for landlocked buildings?
No. No, there's not. And I see I'm out of time, if I could just briefly answer.
You may.
That would explain the petition or the complaint in this case, including actions for creations of an easement, unjust enrichment. The complaint was amended to include those prior to the deposition of the defendant, because we were hopeful we would be able to establish some type of an easement so that the buildings could be sold to a third party. After the depositions of the parties, it became clear that we would not be able to establish the elements to create some type of an easement, constructive or not, or unjust enrichment. So we proceeded with the unjust enrichment claim.
Because of the differing values of estimates of the value of the property, is that why the standard review is important?
Absolutely, because the court, unless there's a clearly erroneous decision, I think has to affirm decisions made weighing the credibility and the weight of the evidence, which, again, Judge Steinke clearly found that the weight of the evidence presented by the plaintiff was more persuasive than that of the defendant.
You may. Both of you may ask.
Yesterday I went over about 4 or 5 minutes too, so I apologize.
Was there a contract between the LLC and Gerald Schreiber to sell the buildings for $18,000?
There was no contract to do so. Their only offer to purchase the buildings was made by Gerald Schreiber. The $18,000 came from the assessed value. The attempt was made at the trial court level to try to utilize that as evidence evaluation. We were able to object and say that assessed value is not proper evidence.
But nope. Didn't he make an offer to purchase the buildings for $18,000? And didn't the court direct the receiver to accept that offer?
That is correct.
So does that result in a contract that would displace unjust enrichment?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor, because, again, the only disposition of those buildings could have been to a party that had access to them. And so there is no written contract conveying the buildings. Really, I think the case could have proceeded without that transaction having taken place. The district court made the decision that the unjust enrichment required that the buildings actually be conveyed before we could proceed on the unjust enrichment claim, hence the bifurcation, and that's why that transaction proceeded the way it did.
I wanted to ask you a question about future cases involving dissolutions of limited liability companies. To the extent that we accept the argument that this unjust enrichment claim was a legal claim, where it clearly is interposed in the midst of this equitable proceeding to dissolve the LLC. What potential impact would that have to the rights of future litigants to have a jury on part of the issues and only the court on others?
That's a good question, Justice Castle. I think there is always a right for litigants to have a jury trial. In a dissolution of an LLC action, there are other actions that can be interposed, like this case, like an action for fraud, undue influence, and those types of allegations and those causes of action within a complaint should afford themselves to be heard by a jury, because those claims are not simply just equitable as the dissolution of an LLC would be. To answer your question, I don't think it would affect future cases involving dissolution of LLCs that are accompanied by additional causes of action at law.
With that, I am well out of time. I would ask that the court affirm the decision of the district court in both its finding and its judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
Yes,
52
seconds.
52 seconds, Mr. Domina. We will actually give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have 2 points. I'll try to do those in 2 minutes. This is the first one. The difference between the value of the land with and without the buildings measures an impact on the value of my client's real estate. He owns title to that property. The limited liability company operating agreement requires dissolution in a process that values the assets of the LLC, not the assets of Jerry Schreiber. So the entire concept of using a comparative analysis to determine the value of the buildings is inconsistent with a contract of the parties. That's the first point. The second point goes to what Justice Papik and Justice Castle have asked about, and that is, how do we reconcile these standards of review and what is legal and what is equitable? In the City of Scotts Bluff versus Waste Connection case, you adopted Section 3 of the Restatement 3rd of restitution. I want to direct your attention to these words from the comments in Section 1 of that restatement, which define restitution. Lord Mansfield's famous statement in Moses versus McFarland, 1760, were, in one word, the gist of this kind of action is that the defendant, upon the circumstances of the case, is obliged by the ties of natural justice and equity to refund the money. Explaining restitution as the embodiment of natural justice and equity gives a special moral attractiveness. Restitution, in this view, is the aspect of our legal system that makes the most direct appeal to standards of equitable and conscientious behavior as a source of enforceable obligations. I urge the court to reconsider its previous expressions of the standard of review and evaluate the thicket that we found ourselves in today on this issue in light of those words. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. That concludes arguments in Schreiber Brothers Hog Company, LLC.